Today's episode involves the discussion of sexual abuse, religion, psychopathy, domestic abuse, anti-LGBT rhetoric, and power. This can be a very triggering topic, particularly to those who may have left religion. Please listen to this episode with caution. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime, a true crime podcast hosted by me, Justice, a doctor of forensic psychology,
and me, Rebecca, a criminologist.
You won't find clickbait titles, selfie thumbnails, or spooky music to set the mood here. But what you will find is ethical true crime with extra focus on empathy, accuracy, and a viewpoint from professionals.
So grab your coffee and let's get started.
Normally for Dr. Crime, we want to discuss true crime cases. Most of our cases that we have covered involve one victim with a clear-cut understanding of the crime. We discuss how the crime works, the criminal psychology, and the criminology of this case. This episode will be a different experience. This is crime on such a large scale that it crosses multiple state boundaries. This is not one specific crime nor a specific criminal. This crime is the grooming, sexual abuse, and the multiple crimes committed in the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Church, or for short, IFB.
The IFB religion is a sublet of Christianity who generally hold conservative Baptist beliefs. The reason it's called independent is because the church is independent from each other, but they still fall under the Baptist umbrella.
Now, the ideology that the churches of IFB believe are that of the literal interpretation of the Bible, meaning the churches hold extremely conservative views. The church is very domineering and controlling as well, which is why it translates to the fundamentalism.
As you may have predicted, it's not just the conservative views that have landed the church on this episode. What makes the church a Dr. Crime episode is the 412 reported sexual abuse allegations over 187 churches. And those are just the reported ones.
Not only is there the dark world of sexual abuse, but there is also the encouragement of physical abuse, domestic abuse, controlling others, and financial crimes. With us today is someone who grew up in the IFB and left the church after she graduated high school. Everyone, please welcome
Megan. Hi.
Hi, Megan. So thank you so much for being on the show today. And I know that this can be a very disturbing topic. So please feel free to let us know if you don't feel comfortable answering a question. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the church.
Absolutely. So my family were IFBers before I was born. I was born into an IFB church where I spent my earliest childhood memories in the church nursery, helping out at the church, very, very active my entire life, where I ended up going to a Christian high school, and I haven't been back since I graduated.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And if you don't mind me asking about it, what was your experience like in the IFB?
Well, as you can imagine, like you said, there's a lot of power and control. But what's most concerning is the programming that they instill in you at a very early age and this expectation of complete uniformity within the members. There's to be no deviation from the uniformity. Everyone's supposed to be a very specific cookie cutter type of person. And if you stray away from who you're supposed to be, there are extreme consequences.
And what were those consequences like?
It would be very typical for you to receive basically a shun from the community, where others are instructed not to be around you because you're not right with God. All of your personal business is going to be information that everybody in the community knows about. They use the guise of praying for you as an excuse to find out everything about you. And they use that information to control you.
So what was it like every day being dictated and controlled by religion? I mean, you weren't even supposed to go to the movies or listen to quote unquote secular music. You could only go to specific restaurants that didn't serve alcohol. What was that like having every part of your life dictated?
As you can imagine, it's really difficult, especially for a child or a teenager who already feels that pressure of being controlled. But it's just so encompassing that you're not allowed to question that that's the wrong move, that that's too controlling. everybody else is going through the same thing. So if you try to talk to your peers about it, to try to see if they're feeling a particular way about it, you're immediately shut down. And it's considered ungodly and unholy. And it's an indication that your spirit has not been what they would call bridled enough, which is where they're instructed to break your spirit to make you more subordinate.
Lots of submission as well.
Absolutely.
It's crazy that it sounds like that submission and that subordination starts at such a young age too.
It does. I mean, I remember there were songs when you're 3 or 4 years old, you're expected to learn, that tell you that you are to be seen but not heard. And these songs teach you how to be a good little Christian, and you need to not make any noise, and just doing things that are developmentally inappropriate for children that age.
So I also kind of wanted to like discuss a little bit. You were born as the IFB, but you didn't really go to the school until high school.
Absolutely. So
at the time you did go to the school, when you were more immersed into the church, did you believe everything they were teaching you?
I didn't deep down, but as almost a survival method, I had to try to force myself to believe it, because I was already ostracized from the group coming in as a public schooler, where most of my peers had known each other since they were in diapers, and their parents since they were in diapers, and it's very multi-generational within that community. So for me to arrive late to the party, I was already looked at as an automatic bad influence among everyone else in the community. So I was even more heavily scrutinized than most of the other people that were there. So when I came to Trinity, the school that I went to, it was pretty immediate that I noticed some of the strange methods of control and manipulation. But I was immediately instructed to just accept it. And if I didn't, then I would receive biblical counseling or punishments within the school or church, as well as societal punishments as well for my peer group.
Now, at the end of your tenure at the school, you know, you came in as a public school student your freshman year, you graduated as a senior. Do you feel that somewhere along the line you did get that brainwashing where you did start to believe because of the grooming?
Absolutely. It's just impossible for you to be subjected to that kind of power and control over and over and over, day in, day out, and for it not to at least soak in at some level. I truly began that the problem, I believe that the problem was me. I thought that I just wasn't Christian enough, or that I wasn't really saved, or I wasn't really believing everything that I was supposed to believe. And therefore, it was a punishment from God that I was not fully believing this, and it was my fault. They use shame and guilt as one of their manipulation tactics, and it's very, very effective, especially for a young person who already struggles with these self-esteem issues. They ingrain that into you from a very early age. You're taught that your time on earth is supposed to be filled with trials and tribulations, and if you're not being persecuted, then you're not a good enough Christian. So what they do is they intentionally depress you and make you feel that your only relief will be when you die and you go to heaven with God, so that they can keep your self-esteem low, so that way you are easily controlled. And in addition to that, what they like to do is they immediately instill in you this us versus them mentality of you're supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. And what that means is that your job is to be a wanderer, a traveler while you are on planet Earth. And then when you are out in the community, you are only to associate with people outside of IFB if you are trying to convert them and you are trying to bring them to your church. So they use isolation, they use these self-esteem triggers to keep you controlled. And they strongly discourage you seeking mental health treatment. It's taught that therapy is sinful because it takes away from personal responsibility, and you don't make the changes you need to make in your life, and because someone is telling you it's not your fault. So because of that, they also don't believe in medications. They believe that all mental illness is a sign that you're not right with God. So because of all of those tactics, you are very easily controlled. And it does not stand out as immediately to you that that's what's going on. It's very subtle, and it's broken down into very, very small steps that are very easy to miss if you're not paying attention.
Absolutely. I mean, when we even think about children that are groomed, not just in the religious sector, but in any sector, that's how they start. They start that by isolation. We're going to cover that in a little bit. And of course, we had mentioned earlier, in this church, or not your church specifically, but in the IFB sector, there were over 412 sexual abuse allegations. When did you find out about that and the crimes of the church?
So that wasn't until my senior year of high school. The church/school that I was going to was featured on an episode of 2020 about cults. And there was a young lady who had been raped and who had gotten pregnant from the rape. And the church had covered the rape up, and they sent her off to impede with the police investigation. And when the episode aired, the tone of the entire community had been shifted, where we were now polarized between groups that felt that things weren't handled the right way and people who felt that it was handled the right way, but God's ways are not man's ways. And so it wouldn't make sense, but we just needed to trust the leaders in the community that things were handled the way that God would handle them. And it was a really tough time. I remember that my principal came into our classroom and gave us a lecture instructing us not to talk to the media. And they told us, don't be upset with them. The news crew are doing the best they can. They just don't understand God's ways.
Gotcha.
And it was very common for us to have those kinds of talks and disclaimers. To kind of stomp out any questions that we might be having. It was very common for them to remind us that if God's laws and man's laws were ever at odds, we were expected to follow God's laws and that we would be rewarded in heaven for that.
And that's interesting that you bring that up, because we do talk about that later in the episode as well. Because being able to kind of disobey the law, if God allows it,
yes,
does make room for creating offenders as well.
Absolutely.
So we'll kind of get into that a little bit later as well. Now, you said you heard this senior year. This was a very tough time for you because you went in kind of not really believing anything, but then it turned into, I'm just not a good enough Christian to understand. And then these allegations came out. Did it take a while for you for that to sink in? Because at that point, this was senior year, so you were kind of already like, I'm just not a good Christian. Did it take a while for you to understand the heftiness of the allegations?
Absolutely. In fact, it took years for me to truly understand the depth to how wrong this was. Mm-hmm. It kind of came in waves. My immediate thoughts were that it was wrong, but I felt that there was more that I just didn't understand. And
right, because you weren't a good enough Christian. And,
exactly. Right. Also, there's very, very heavy misogyny. So me being a female also would have made me feel like I just won't understand the same way that a man would, a man in power. I was right. A child. And at the time, it was very, very common for kids to be very heavily disrespected in that community, and mm-hmm. you have no sense of autonomy. You can't make any kind of your own decisions. So it instills a lot of doubt in young people, and it makes them feel like they're incapable and that they are nothing on their own. They need to rely on the older men in the community to lead them in the right direction. So because of which, I did not trust my own opinions.
Absolutely. And, you know, you just brought it up yourself about doubt. Did you believe the allegations? Did it take a while for you to understand even what the allegations were?
I believed them very early on. It was just the aspect of whether or not it was the right thing to do, and understanding why it happened made me feel like there must be more to the story that the media was twisting. I knew that Trinity was wrong and I knew that their response was wrong. I just didn't understand the gravity of it at the time.
Absolutely.
Did I hear you right? I know you said this was a little while ago. I've just been kind of listening to you guys talk, but did you say that you weren't allowed to associate with individuals who didn't practice the same faith as you?
Oh, absolutely. There is this very common metaphor in the Christian community where if you put one good apple in a bag with two bad apples, that it wouldn't take long for the good apple to become a bad apple as well. And they used that as often as they could to explain to you why it's important for you to remove yourself from the influences of the outside world. They tell you that every day Satan is trying to brainwash you in the media and in society, and that it's more important to be brainwashed with the word of God, and it's more important to be brainwashed in the right theology. And your only exception for being able to associate with outsiders is if you are trying to convert them.
Which is how we got away with our friendship, was because she's like, yeah, I'm trying to convert her. Meanwhile, that was not happening. we met freshman year of high school. We had a bunch of mutual friends, so we had become friends. And there was an incident, and her family wanted her to go to the church high school. And so that kind of was, not to put a strain on our friendship, because her parents and her family love me and still do love me more than they love her.
it's true.
But I do remember she'd be like, oh, let's come to youth group. Cause that was really the only way I could be friends with her, but not even necessarily for her family. Like, her family didn't mind our friendship because I was out of faith. It was more or less her church. She wasn't allowed to talk about me unless she was trying to convert me. Which is kind of weird to think back now, but it was definitely the only way we could have been friends was her trying to recruit me.
So is your family, do they still practice?
My family does practice. However, they're not as strict as Trinity and the typical IFB church is. Their thought process is that the church in the community is not perfect, but they check the most boxes off of their checklist for what they're looking for. So they're willing to overlook a lot of the strict environment in order to get what they feel is important out of their religion.
And I think as an outsider as well, when I go over their houses, I don't feel inundated like a lot of people do when they do go over like someone in the IFB's home. It's not, I mean, her grandmother's the sweetest person in the entire world. I don't feel like she's only talking about religion and she's forcing me to believe what she believes. It's not that at all. She might say like, well, the Lord sent you to Megan, or she might say things like that. I don't find that offensive at all. So I find her family to have a very good balance between what they believe in versus kind of how the stereotype of that type of family would come in.
Well, I mean, just the fact that they still, like, you guys still have a relationship despite you not being as involved in the church or involved in the church anymore. Like, that, I think that speaks volumes that they're willing to prioritize their family.
Absolutely. And I consider myself to be very, very lucky for that, because that is not commonplace in that community whatsoever. And when I started to break away from the IFB, that weighed very heavily on my mind. I didn't know how they would respond at first, because they are still so integrated in the IFB community. I had no idea if I was going to be ostracized from my family or not. But I got very lucky. My family is pretty fantastic, and they do prioritize their family over anything else. But unfortunately, that's not the case for many of the people that I grew up with and many of the other people in this community.
Absolutely. And I do just kind of want to rewind for a second. Rebecca, did you have any other questions? Okay. I wanted that part out. So I did just want to back up. You had talked about the 2020 episode that had come out during your senior year and how it was a part of a cult. Now, I do want to mention that the IFP does have very cult-like behavior. There's no denying that. So I want to talk about what classifies as a cult so we can really understand what's going on psychologically. And in order to classify a cult, there needs to be specific ramifications and traits. And there are four big ones. Now, the first one is that the group is focused on a living leader to whom members seem to display excessive, zealous, unquestioning commitment. So these would be like the highest of the high in your specific church. And everyone in the church focuses on that one person and they don't question it. And then the group is preoccupied with bringing in new members, which, like we had said earlier, that was the only way she could hang out with people that were not in the church, was she was trying to, quote unquote, convince them to bring in new people. And of course, when you're bringing in new people, the group is going to be preoccupied with making money. So part of this too is making all that money, which then in turn leads for financial crimes, and we don't want to get justice into white collar crime. So then the last thing is questioning and doubt and dissent are discouraged or even punished, which Megan had even already said that those were big things. If you questioned or doubted the leaders, you were going to be punished. You would be given humiliation. You'd be forced to tell the sins that you didn't believe them and that everyone would pray that you would. So understanding that that's how you can classify a cult, you also need to understand what it takes to start a cult, because even as new generations coming in, they're, you know, creating a new cult, I guess you could say, even though you're still a part of a cult, you're still shifting leaders. And part of something you need is to have a charismatic leader, and that's someone who everyone's going to love, everyone's going to trust, they're going to be charismatic, they're going to be loved, they're going to be someone that you can trust. And they, you know, most of the time with charisma comes good looks. And also, to start a cult, you need a belief system. You need to believe in something that no one else believes in. It's only the select few that are a part of this. And then we have the ability to control through beliefs. And that would be controlling women and children through the belief of the Bible. And lastly, the systems of influence. Now, the IFB did have all of those. They had the leaders, even some were the leaders of super churches, as they are called. I mean, IFB spans across the entire country. The leaders are all charismatic men because women weren't allowed to be in positions of power. There was this belief set of the word of God. The most notable was the control through belief set. I mean, women weren't even allowed to have short hair and men couldn't have long hair. Women were to be godly housewives and homemakers. They could occasionally work as teachers or daycare workers, but nothing more than that. And then you have children who were meant to be seen, not heard. Children were to be hit, you know, hard enough for there to be bruises so that people could say, okay, you're able to break them, or why aren't you hitting them harder? Men were in complete control over women and children in this, in, you know, the IFB. And then use the word of God as the reason. There, of course, was the system of influence as well. And that's the peer pressure. This is the, it's been this way forever. And then the, you know, how the older generations paved the way for the current status quo. So all of these are really heavy traits of a cult, and how even in godly religions, they're supposed to be that, they're supposed to be separation church and state. We all know that does not happen. So we're having, you know, people think of cults like the Jonestown cult or the Nexium cult. Like, there's so many different things that people think of just weird, but it's not. It's in everyday religion that people go to. And, you know, even talking about FLDS, the Fundamentalist of Latter-day Saints, people kind of look at as like, oh, we would never fall into that, but you can. And so now that we've talked a little bit about cult behavior, is that something you saw every day, Megan? Did you see this behavior?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They controlled every aspect of your life. And if you were to ask any questions, particularly in the school, you would get in trouble for it. I remember I would ask too many questions after Bible class, and my Bible teacher would pull me aside and ask me what side I was on. Like, it was something from a movie. It was just ridiculous. They didn't want me to start thinking about it. They wanted me to unquestioningly believe what they were telling me. Every single aspect of our lives were controlled for us. Our dress code was unbelievably strict. We had to wear skirts that were well beyond our knees. If we ever showed our knees, we would get talked to. Our necklines had to be around our collarbones. We couldn't wear anything that was too form-fitting, which is open to interpretation because it's so subjective. Mm-hmm. They get to tell you what's too tight and what's not too tight. And what's disturbing is just how early on this dress code comes into play. And it took me a long time to realize that they were just sexualizing children. Mm-hmm. Everything among what you wore, anything having to do with your clothes, somehow became about sex.
And it also wasn't fair because I feel really bad for saying this, but through teenagehood, Megan had huge boobs. Huge, huge, probably the biggest out of anyone I know. And we joked around because I was the exact opposite end of the spectrum. So, but she would get in trouble just for wearing a shirt. The shirt wasn't tight. It was just because she had big boobs. She would always get in trouble for her shirts not looking the right way and for distracting men. Even though she would have a turtleneck on and it was two sizes too big, you couldn't get away from them. So you would even get in trouble for that. I remember that.
Oh, yes. And they were so, so concerned with uniformity that that's really what it became about. I even got in trouble once for when I went to Disney with my parents, and I came back with one of those hair wraps with the colorful thread. And my teacher pulled me aside, and I quote her exact words for telling me that I had to take them out because they were too Jamaican looking.
What?
So they were upset with me because I wore a shirt from Disney, and Disney has magic, which is of the devil. They used everything they can to control you. They would isolate you. They would make sure you knew what your place was. It was very, very apparent who the people of power were and what your role was. They instructed women to be meek. And what meekness means isn't just being timid. They tell you that it's bridled strength. So by not saying anything and by turning the other cheek and by staying quiet, you're actually in a position of more power, and you're actually somebody who is showing more strength than somebody who just speaks up for themselves and thinks their own thoughts. They also use Bible verses to tell you that you can't trust yourself. Particularly one that my church loved was Jeremiah 17:9, which tells you that your heart is wicked above all things, who can know it. And that tells you that you can only trust God. And the only good thing about you is God, if you've accepted him as your savior, that you cannot trust your heart. You cannot trust your instincts. The only thing you can do is pray to God for guidance and to go against your own sinful nature.
So I also just kind of wanted to bring up again, you know, you talked about isolation and you talked about being a cult. And even how you would recruit people, because it wasn't just like your normal everyday friends, people like me that you were trying to recruit. You went on mission trips to recruit people, right?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes we would get out of class early to hop on a school bus and go across the street from the local high school and to try to recruit them to various youth group events. We would go up to random people on the street. We would go to the mall, and we'd get out of class to do this. We'd go on missions trips. I went to Phoenix, Arizona one year. And we would just go door-to-door canvassing, and we would do everything we could to try to bring people to church, because it's more than just the typical, trying to share your, it becomes very, very important for your relationship with God, but also your relationship with the community. Mm-hmm. It makes you look good to other people, and your reputation is pretty much everything in these communities. And if you have a bad reputation, there are always consequences for that.
Okay. So it's interesting that you brought up the men who were in charge of the group. So they were the ones that were kind of calling all of the shots, and you being a female and a juvenile, you were the least respected out of the community. Did you feel the effects that power had over you?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that you did was so intensely watched, and you had to make sure that you were doing everything that these men were telling you to do at all times. And some of these men you barely knew, but you knew that they were more important than you were. For example, we had traveling evangelists come to our community from some of the institutions that our church community would look up to. And these men you might have only met once or twice or maybe never at all. But whatever they said, you had to do it, because they were the ones that had the closest relationship with God. They're the ones that were the leaders and that God chose to be leaders. So it didn't really matter what they said or if you agreed with it, you had to do everything that they told you. For example, I was already out of the community for a year, and I had posted on my Facebook the song Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult, and I got immediately sent a message from a traveling evangelist that I had met at my church, who was chastising me for posting this song. And he asked me if I knew for sure if I was going to heaven when I died. And he started it off like, you know, you'd expect a Christian to have that kind of conversation. And then I told him, yeah, I went to Trinity. I know this, I know that. And he tells me that I should know better for posting that kind of song. And I apologized for offending him. And he was very quick to let me know that I didn't just offend him, but I offended God by posting that song. They're very, very strict with music. They believe that anything with a backbeat whatsoever, anything you can tap your foot to, is sexual, and that the devil is going to use it to sexualize children and to sexualize society. And it's just really strange. Everything always boils down to sex for IFB. They're more obsessed with sex than anybody I've ever met.
Now, speaking of sex, you know, we talked about just 412 plus allegations, and I say plus because 412 reported, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Is it okay to ask if you were one of those victims? Did you witness any of those victims?
I'm lucky enough that I was not a victim at that church, no. But I did know plenty of girls who were victimized that way, especially after this episode came out on 2020 and inspired a lot of my peers to come forward and say that their stepfathers or fathers had been molesting them, or the men for the children they babysat were raping them. But it was very common in that community, especially when they're so centered around sex, and virginity is such a huge, huge, huge part of your life. You're told that that's where your value is. You're made to sign virginity pledges in your Bibles, and it's talked about all the time, almost at least once, maybe twice a week, about how that's where your worth is, and that, you know, that they also, they're really fond of metaphors and allegories, but one that they use a lot is they'll hand out flowers and have you pass around the flower and then ask you, do you want the flower that's been passed around, or do you want this fresh flower that still has all of its petals intact? And
the fact that they even use the term flower for virginity and then like that,
it's pretty gross. It's pretty gross, but that's what you really start to believe over time, just from the constant exposure. Mm-hmm. And you start to really believe that that's where your value is, to the point where if you do start to see someone intimately, or you do start to explore your sexuality, there is deep levels of shame and guilt that you can experience even years after you've already left the church.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know we had kind of touched on this earlier, but did any of the allegations truly shock you? I mean, these were men that were in positions of power and they were supposed to be good people. So what was it like to see, like, these people are good people, but there's also these allegations? Did anything shock you?
It was pretty heartbreaking. At the time, I was just so filled with self-doubt and did not trust my own opinions that I can't even say whether or not they shocked me. It did make me very sad for my peers and the people that I knew. One that did definitely shock me was actually this past year. The pastor of my very first church, Bible Baptist Church in Nashua, before I went to Trinity, the pastor there, Stephen Bates, was recently arrested for charges of child pornography. And that I found to be very heartbreaking. It wasn't surprising because there were allegations before that could never be proved, but it's just devastating when you see someone that has the trust of an entire community, mm-hmm. and is trusted to lead people and use that power to abuse other people. It's devastating.
The power and the charisma, because they're so charismatic, they fair to say that most people wouldn't suspect anything.
Right.
And I think that brings up a really important topic. And that's psychopathy. And statistically speaking, those who are clinical psychopaths are most likely to take positions of power. And psychopathy is not a true diagnosis, however, can be classified under the DSM, which is a diagnostic statistic manual, which is like the Bible of diagnosing mental health, as antisocial personality disorder. Now, there is a difference between sociopaths and psychopaths. However, some research suggests that those who are genetically antisocial are psychopaths, while trauma and circumstances make the person a sociopath. So one's a nature, one's a nurture kind of deal. But there is some other research that kind of indicates different things. Psychopaths can be are much more charismatic. They're more liked. They're likely to hold a job and be in positions of power, where sociopaths are likely to be the creep in the basement that we all assume psychopaths and sociopaths are. So there are the differences. And so since this is all about power and control, I would label a lot of these people under the psychopath umbrella. Because a psychopath is someone who craves power and control. That's why they're attracted to jobs like police, lawyer, doctor, politician, a clergyman, or religious figure. Those are the five top jobs that psychopaths are likely to hold. And those are all high paying. They're competitive jobs. They're jobs where there can be power and control. And I don't think people even realize how many other people exhibit psychopathic traits. I feel like psychopath is so widely incorrectly used. And Rebecca, we see this all the time in true crime.
Yep.
Oh, you committed a crime, you're a psychopath. Oh, you did this one bad thing to me, you didn't treat me well, you're a narcissist. That's not how that works. the big pet peeve of Rebecca and us. But part of that is also because some people don't even realize that they are psychopaths, because the biggest part of psychopathy is the lack of emotion and the lack of empathy. We can't measure on a scale how emotions work because everyone feels things differently, which makes it so hard to determine when someone is just not feeling as deep as they should. So it can be difficult to measure emotions. And almost all cult leaders, especially your big ones, your Mansons, your Nexium, your Jonestown, they all have psychopathic traits. They desire to be admired. They will crawl over anyone and everyone to get exactly what they want, to get that power. They're deceitful. We also have to remember that psychopaths don't, a lot of them don't even commit crimes. So you can be a psychopath and not commit a crime. You don't have to be a criminal to be a psychopath. They are not conclusive with each other. And it's estimated about 1% of the population is a psychopath, which affects more males than females, but it does affect both.
Now, even though there's no diagnosis for psychopathy, there is the HAIR checklist. So that checklist notates the traits that are associated with psychopathy. The research actually states that men who exhibit the traits of psychopathy purposely seek out those positions you mentioned of power and control.
Mm-hmm. And exactly. That's, you know, you have the HAIR checklist, which is 27 behaviors that are found within psychopathy, and then some are ranked higher than others. You can have a high score of 40. The higher the score, the more psychopathic traits you have. And so when you have people that they want power and control, they're not very empathetic, they have a lot of crime, there was a lot of that I heard in these traits of the leaders of the church. Did the powerful men that you incorporate display empathy with their control?
Well, that's the part that I found to be the most disturbing when it comes to this topic, is that they intentionally twist things to make it look like their power and control is a display of empathy. They talk down on what they call the legalistic churches, which are the churches that are perceived as cold and unwelcoming and not warm and non-empathetic and very rules-based. So that way they can distance themselves from being that. And that way you don't perceive them to be that. But they tell you that they're controlling you because they love you. They're putting power over you because that's what God wants, and it's what you want deep down, that you want to be controlled, you want to be led.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're so broken down, you start to believe it. You just need somebody else to tell you what to do because you've never been prepared to make your own decisions before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, a big thing that we have been talking about this entire time is that idea of control. That's all that religion is just controlling others. And now, even though you're born into the church, you aren't always associated the way you were in high school.
Right.
Because your family was that border of, like, we believe in some of the things. We just go on church on Sundays and on holidays. But we're not, like, super immersed into the culture until you went to the high school.
Absolutely.
How did they draw you in? How were they able to get you in and change your minds from, I don't really sure I believe this deep down, into towards the end, you literally were like, no, like, I need to be a better Christian. Like, how did that happen?
So before I went to the high school, I was instructed to be a missionary in my everyday life. I was to be a living example for Christ wherever I went in my community, in school. But then when I went to the school, I was so heavily submerged in the entire culture, where I was in the building 6 out of 7 days a week. We were expected to go to church Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday night, Wednesday night, as well as any kind of events that they had for youth group or in the community. So it was just exposure for a lot of it. And then when you were bombarded by that constantly, just subconsciously, things start to seep in. You don't trust yourself anymore. So you become entirely receptive to everything that they tell you. There's so much pressure for you to be a very specific way. And when most of your peers are that way and you're not, you don't want to be the one that stands out. And you definitely internalize everything that they say, and you believe that you are the problem. And this is a survival method. You have to do what it takes in order to make it through. There's a lot of pressure to be perfect. There's a lot of pressure to do everything to the best of your abilities. So much so that it was very, very widely known that my particular class struggled with eating disorders. Almost every single girl in my class, there were about 27 kids in my grade, about half of them were girls. And it got to the point where the principal gave us a lecture before Thanksgiving break one year and told us that we needed to eat an entire turkey before we came back, making a joke of it, because everybody knew just how sick a lot of the girls in my class were. Some of them were passing out during the day. Just from that level of control, it's to be expected.
And big thing about eating disorders and control too is, and this doesn't happen for every case, but there has been research where people that don't feel control in their everyday life, especially in places like that, are likely to develop eating disorders, because eating is one of the very few things you can control.
Right.
Everything in your life is spinning out of control. Everyone else can tell you what to do and what to do. What they can't do is tell you what you can eat and when you can eat it. So that's a fight for control and body autonomy at that point.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, you had mentioned isolation earlier and how they would isolate you. That's such a big thing, because isolation is the biggest tactic any groomer has within the church, within, you know, with outside of the church. Any type of relationship where there's meant to be controlled, there is going to be grooming, because you don't just go from happy, hunky dory little 14-year-old girl to completely submissive in just, hey, do this. That doesn't happen, you know. Essentially, grooming is the process of controlling a victim and finding someone who is vulnerable and looking to connect with others, then gaining control of them. That just doesn't happen overnight. That's a long process. And to be clear, isolation is a process in which someone will form a relationship and then convince you that everyone else is bad. No one can love you like they can love you. And children and teens, they'll isolate the child by saying, I understand you, your parents don't, your friends don't, they don't love you, only I love you. And you should tell your mom how mad you are at her, because she doesn't even care about you anyway. That's going to set up a lot of tension, and that's how they're going to isolate you. And these kind of statements can isolate a very vulnerable person very quickly. And as someone who went through that process, what was it like for you as it happened? Did you get sucked into that isolation?
Oh, without a doubt. They prey upon people
who already feel lonely and already feel like they need to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And that's something that's instilled in you very early on. I felt like they were the right, if there was a right answer, they were the only ones. That was the only right answer. And either I could accept it or I couldn't. And if I couldn't, then that was my fault. That was my problem.
And I know you had mentioned earlier some of the ways that they would isolate you is us versus them. You know, you couldn't associate with anyone outside of denominations. So essentially our friendship wasn't supposed to be happening. No movies. You couldn't go out for music. You couldn't. Your goal was just to get people into the church. And right. So if you couldn't hang out at the movies or listen to music, you're already isolated from the normal general population because you didn't have anything in common with them.
Absolutely. And, you know, a big thing that they would push on you is that you don't want to be a stumbling block to other people. And what that means is you don't want what you do to impede someone else's spiritual walk and spiritual journey. So everything that you do from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed is being watched, and you need to be extra cautious about everything. So you're taught to overthink every action that you have, and you need to think about everything that you do. And because of that, you're hyper aware all the time. They teach you to be hyper vigilant. And when you're in that mindset, you are so much more susceptible to becoming feeling isolated.
Right. And once that isolation kicks in, there have been research that says once you hit isolation, the groomer knows that they've won.
Right.
That's how they know they've won. Are you still feeling the effects of being groomed? What are some of the long-term mental illnesses that you or your peer have dealt with, or long-term effects that you have dealt with for the grooming?
Absolutely. I'm now a 29-year-old woman, and I still struggle with an overwhelming sense of self-doubt. I still have a hard time trusting that I know what I'm doing, feeling capable. And one thing that really, really weighs heavily on my everyday life is just constantly feeling guilt and shame for things that I shouldn't feel guilt and shame for.
Mm-hmm. In talking about those things that you've dealt with, I know a lot of your peers had eating disorders and depression, and you couldn't even seek counseling for that. You couldn't get help for that, which is, again, even more isolating. You don't have a third party to look at you and say, that's not okay.
Right. That's kind of like what I was thinking, too, is we were just talking so in depth about the isolation and about how you're isolated from your normal peers and, you know, from people that may not have the same faith as you or whatever, but you're also isolated from the peers that are in your faith group or that do believe the same things as you, because you said earlier you can't even talk to them because you'll get in trouble.
Right.
So it's not like you're literally just struggling completely alone, and not even just struggling, but just living.
Yeah. That was a very common theme of my high school years. I felt completely alone for all 4 years. I didn't have anybody to go to besides, thank God, Justice I could go to for anything, but she was truly the only person I could talk to. I couldn't talk to my family. I couldn't talk to anyone I went to school with. I couldn't talk to people that I looked up to in the community. She was the only person I could talk to, and it took me a long time to even be okay with saying certain things to Justice or her mom. And thank God they were there. They helped me through a lot of what I was going through. But no, it's strange to look back at just how dark those years were, because I felt that they were tough. But, you know, who doesn't think that being a teenager is hard? Who doesn't think mm-hmm. that being a teenager is lonely? So it's hard to see just how wrong it is in the moment when that's to be expected. But looking back, I can now appreciate as a 29-year-old woman the extent to which they took that and how far from okay a lot of that really was.
Mm-hmm. And Rebecca said something that I didn't even, I guess, put together, was everyone felt alone, right? because everyone else was also so deeply groomed that they were afraid that if they talked to anyone else, they would get in trouble.
Absolutely.
So it just kind of like makes you think like, okay, there's 27 children in this graduating class. Not a single one of them can talk to each other, right? Because they're all pitted against each other, and that you all have such self-hatred because right. If I say something, if I'm not feeling godly enough, then I'm going to get in trouble.
Right.
Like, it's so hard to wrap your mind around that.
Well, another,
trouble, but you're going to think that your peers think you're less godly now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a big theme. You didn't want to be talked to by the people that we called the holier than thous. Those are the people that thought that they had the closest walk with God. You didn't want to be looked down upon by them. But also, you're expected to give what they call testimonies very frequently. And that's when you share sin that you're working through, and your experience and just how thankful you are that you were able to get through something. Those are the only real, genuine moments, the real heart-to-hearts that you can really have. And I feel like they keep you isolated so they can get more of those gold nuggets that they can use to perpetuate their propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, in this episode, we talked about the many crimes of IFB, the grooming, the sexual abuse, the domestic abuse, because women were supposed to be homemakers, and that was it. And if they stepped out of line, men had the power to do what they wanted. There were 412 accusations, and I just keep repeating that number because I feel like it's so hard to comprehend. 412 people accused the church of sexual assault. And while that number is astounding, is there likely many, many more that we don't know about because of the victim grooming and conditioning?
Oh, wholeheartedly, yes. You're told to turn the other cheek and forgive. And if the person who assaulted you is married or has children, you're supposed to think of their wife and their kids before yourself. You're instructed to be selfless in every act that you have made, every thought that you have, because that's another big part of this religion, is that God can see your thoughts too, not just your actions. So even your thoughts are being controlled. So you need to make sure that everything that you do brings God glory, and making it not about yourself. And to victimize yourself is to be putting all of the focus on yourself, which takes away from God. Mm-hmm. So there are many different layers to why you cannot see yourself as a victim in any way, shape, or form, and that you just need to move on with your life, and you need to make sure that you are a good testimony, because we're taught that you can disobey the law in the name of God. That opens up to a lot of questions. Instead of getting angry at God or anger at the person that abused you, you're instructed to believe that God's ways are not man's ways. And you're instructed to believe that God brought this trial to you as a blessing in disguise, that this is really an opportunity to strengthen your relationship with God and to lean not on your own understanding. Because in perfect times, when things are going great, you forget to tell God thank you, and you forget to lean on God. But it's during the hard times in your life that your relationship with God gets stronger. Mm-hmm. So you're taught that when bad things happen to you, it's usually because God wants to challenge you so that your relationship can get stronger with God.
That's so, like, wild to wrap your head around. You had mentioned earlier, too, that you were taught to be in the world, not of the world. Can you explain that? What is that even? I don't understand that part.
Absolutely. So we're taught that heaven is our home and our eternal resting place is with God, and that our life on earth is but a vapor and it will be over in the blink of an eye. So we're to be wanderers and travelers of this world. But in the Bible, Satan is given dominion over the earth. So his influence is very heavy on people on planet Earth. We're not to associate with people who aren't Christians unless we are trying to, you know, give them the gift of eternal life and help them to see their sin and why they need God. And you're told that this is not your home, and that instills in you an even deeper feeling of isolation and being an outsider. Mm-hmm. Because you walk around feeling like you don't belong, and that one day you're gonna go home, and that's when you die. And that again breeds a lot of suicidal ideation in Christians of all ages.
Absolutely. I can't even wrap my head around just that thought process, and the thought process too, that, you know, you had mentioned that you can disobey the law in the name of the God.
Yes, absolutely. Because God's law is the sovereign law. God's law oversees and supersedes any other law. Of course, you're not supposed to disobey the law. You're not supposed to disobey police officers. But if the two are ever at odds, you are supposed to follow God's rules.
If that's the case, and that means it's like if the abuse is just allowed, if God is just allowing this abuse, that means that the men in the community were also sort of groomed to be able to commit any crime and just sort of get away with it. Like, they're literally taught it's perfectly okay to do this. Do you think that they genuinely believed that what they were doing was okay because God allowed it?
Oh, wholeheartedly. That would come out in jokes in elementary, middle, and high school with the boys constantly throwing the misogynistic, go make me a sandwich kind of jokes. It's very heavily ingrained in little boys that they're to be the leaders one day, and that one day they're to be disciplining their wives and to be disciplining their children for God. So they're taught very, very early on what their roles are.
And I mean, they probably, like, one part of them knew it was wrong, but also if they grew up in the church, like you said, it's a very generational thing. So if you know, you have little boys and you have little girls, little boys grew up in the church and it's all they've ever known. And as a child, again, no contact with outside, then they're going to be kind of groomed to become a predator. And that's definitely almost paving the way. You know, you have this innocent little 5-year-old, but he's being told it's okay to hurt women. He's being told that you listen to God and to God's will, and that any urges that he have, women are supposed to submit to him, even at as young as 5.
Right.
So particularly earlier that we mentioned how cults use this is how it's been for decades, excuse. That's why they're probably that it's allowed for little boys. And so I think that especially like as the generations go on, they might genuinely not understand that they were groomed to commit these crimes.
Absolutely. These ideals are instilled in you before you can walk and talk. They become a pillar of who you are to your core that you don't even know to question it because it's so deeply ingrained in you. And what's really hard is that a lot of these church members will twist scriptures to fit their own personal narratives all the time. They will cherry pick Bible verses and parts of Bible verses and twist them for confirmation bias for things that really have nothing to do with the Bible whatsoever. You know, the fundamentalists claim that they believe in the most literal interpretations of the Bible. However, a lot of their beliefs, a lot of their values are nowhere to be found in scriptures, but they're still twisted and used to support these beliefs.
So that's probably where the physical abuse and domestic abuse came in as well. I mean, fitting the scripture to get that confirmation bias and to get that achieved amount of power and control. I know we talked about some of your friends and your classmates' stories about the sexual abuse. What about domestic abuse or physical abuse just in the household? What are some of the things or stories you heard?
Well, almost everybody that I knew was spanked with an object like a wooden paddle or a belt or something that was even hung up on their wall in their home for physical discipline. Because you're taught, spare the rod, spoil the child. And it's in the Bible that children are to be spanked. I didn't know of anybody claiming that they were being physically abused, because it was just so widely understood that children are to be spanked. So I'm sure that there were plenty of victims that had no idea where it was taken too far, because nobody ever saw things being taken too far, because everything is very secretive in this community. There were lots of other instances of different kinds of abuse. For example, one of my good friends was secretly a lesbian at this school, and she got caught kissing another girl that went to our school off campus. And when it was found out, my friend was sent away to biblical counseling. She was sent away to live in a house with a bunch of other women, which is totally not going to make her more gay or anything. But then the girl that she was kissing, her mom had worked for the church, and she had to fight for her job as they were trying to fire her. She had to prove what she was going to do to correct her child, and everything was swept under the rug. Nobody could know what was going on. It was a big secret, which again puts emphasis on guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm. And goes back to the isolation and goes back to the self-doubt.
Right.
And I just can't believe that the children had to endure such trauma like that. And then it's just all forgiven by the victim.
Right. Right. It's tough thinking about, but again, when you're in it and that's what you see every day, that's what's normal. That's what's how it should be in any other way other than forgive and forget becomes wrong and becomes the strange answer. You're taught to apologize for being a victim even, and it's definitely hard to wrap your mind around once you've been out of that community for a long time. But again, this programming, this brainwashing is very subtle, and they start it very early on. Mm-hmm. So you don't even know what questions to ask.
And I mean, we also, the 2020 highlighted the victim from your church that spoke up. Charges were eventually pressed. He eventually went to jail, but the church made her go to the jail and say, "I forgive you. Absolutely. I'm sorry for letting you into my house," because this was a trusted man.
Right.
And he said that he needed help, so she let him in. I mean, she's a 15-year-old girl. Right. This is a high-powered man of the church. What else are you going to do? And then she was forced to apologize to him for creating the situation. She was forced to say, "I forgive you. It's in the past. We don't have to think about it anymore."
And she was forced to stand in front of the entire congregation of the church and apologize to the church for her sin. Church discipline is something that is very, very commonly practiced. She had to stand as a 15-year-old child in front of the entire church and have the pastor tell the entire church what her sin was, and then apologize and ask for forgiveness. And then the church would take a vote as to whether or not to forgive her.
That behavior is so controlling. And it's just, the entire narrative is just controlled. It's like scripted almost. The victim blaming, I thought, you know, geez, justice, like in our community, the victim blaming was bad, but
yeah, it's definitely very difficult to watch the victim blaming, especially it's okay because God said it was okay, and it was the 15-year-old's fault for letting the man she trusted into her home, and because her skirt was not past her knees, she deserved it.
Yeah, I mean, justice, also kind of, what was your thought process when you were friends with Megan going through this type of experience? Especially, like, I think you said at the time that you guys were friends, you were still, like, an active member of the church, and you still thought it was okay.
It was, being her friend during that time, I mean, my mom always taught me that it doesn't matter what someone believes in, you don't have to believe the same thing. So I never had any issues. And she was my best friend at the time. I mean, still is. But I would look at her and say, "Megan, I think this is a cult." And she'd be like, "Oh, my God, you're being so dramatic." And I mean, now it makes sense for 29-year-old Justice that 15-year-old Justice, like, put this together, all coming back to me. But my mom and my brother and I would sit down with Megan and be like, "Hey, like, are you okay? Like, something's not right. Are you in a cult? Like, what's going on here?" And she'd be like, "No, like, everything's fine. They're super nice." And my mom's like, "Okay, well, if anything happens," and my mom made sure to tell her, like, "If anybody touches you inappropriately, you can come to me. These things, you know, there are certain things that aren't okay." And my mom really gave her the talk about sex because it wasn't talked about really in Megan's family. And my mom was the one that was like, "Is anybody touching you?" Like, you know, so we definitely would just had her back. We always just supported her, but my mom, you know, is also supportive of our friendship. And so sometimes Megan would be like, do you want to come to youth group tonight? And I'd be like, "Sure. Like, it's a nice Friday night. Why not?" And my mom would let me. Of course, my mom would be like, "Just make sure you're not alone with any of the older men." Like, my mom knew kind of exactly what was going on, but also knew that there is a level of safety as well, because I kind of knew. If that makes sense. Like, my mom would be like, "Don't be alone. Like, if you feel uncomfortable, give me a call. I'll come get you." But she wanted to support me and Megan's friendship.
That makes sense.
You know, it definitely, just looking back, we tried to tell her numerous times. And then, like, I think one day in our 20s, she was having a conversation with my brother, and it just clicked. And then that's, I think, when Megan's life just, like, completely changed because she's like, oh my god, it was a cult, wasn't it? And we're all just kind of like,
well, we did say.
Well. And of course, now that I'm in forensic psychology and I did a lot of research into cults and, you know, that 2020 special, and as Megan kind of got older, and because her family wasn't so immersed in the culture, she was able to take an objective step back and be like, hey, wait, that wasn't right. So, Megan, is there anything else that you'd like anyone listening to know about your experience or about what you went through?
I just want to highlight one more important thing about this is that even after I left the community, the effects stayed with me for a long time, and a lot of them still are with me. And a lot of the teachings that I learned in this community groomed me to be victims of abuse later on in life, to get into abusive relationships, to be submissive in times where I should have been a self-advocate. And I think it's important for listeners to understand just how dangerous it is to take away someone's personal power, and for them to understand what it really means for someone to not be able to speak up for themselves, to not know how to speak up for themselves. It's something that unfortunately is very, very common. There's going to be an IFB church in almost every town across the country. They're very, very common. But I just want to encourage anyone who's listening, who might have been a survivor of the IFB community, just to know that there are resources out there to help you. There are so many support groups online you can be a part of if you're not comfortable talking in person, because a lot of these are very personal issues and personal topics. Just know that there is help out there for you.
That was so powerful. I want to thank you so much for being a part of today's episode. We've been friends for 15 years at this point, and watching you go through this journey has been so inspiring to see the lows that you came out of and the things that you've realized and the progress you've made to go forward. So thank you for, you know, being here and for being strong enough, because this isn't an easy topic. You know, I see you struggle with it even to this day of going through it, but you're very strong. And anyone else that went through this and came out the other end is very strong. I know I listened to a couple podcasts from the IFB just to understand Megan, and just because it was something that was so close to me, and almost everyone found a different religion to go to. And if you did that, then I'm proud of you for finding something that you could feel comfortable in. And if you didn't and you left the religion completely, I'm also proud of you, because it takes a lot to get out of grooming. It takes a lot to get out of that classical conditioning. It takes a lot to leave that power and to be afraid of if your family's going to support you or not. So just know that you are supported and there are so many resources for you. And Rebecca and I did make the decision that for this episode, if we do make any money, 20% will be donated to an LGBT charity that helps teens and LGBT members that have left and need resources. So we are going to donate to that charity because it's so rampant. But thank you all so much for listening and for being with us for this very heavy episode. I want to thank Megan for being so strong and for being a part of this episode. I am your host, Justice.
And I'm Rebecca, and we can't wait to talk to you next week.